Our guest on Flipside is Larry Mullins, the Knoxville native who left town quickly and ended up touring the world with Iggy Pop and playing with the Residents and the Swans. And who, I mean, there's so many things he's done. I can't even list them all, but that would take up the whole interview. But they've all been fascinating, not to mention his own music released under the name Toby Dammit. So he's our guest today. Even though, Larry, even though you were born a Knoxville native, you left town fairly quickly.
After playing with R.B. Morris?
Was it directly after the set? Or?
Well, it must have been not long after, a few days later or something. I don't know, maybe a week later or something.
Did you start out as a drummer? Or did you play something before that?
No, I guess I started out as a drummer, but I didn't know anything about instruments or playing music. I knew how to listen to records. That was about all. But I ended up with a high school band director who, you know, auditioned me, and you know, he just started throwing me class. You know, I ended up in the percussion section because my best friend was in there, and you know, and then so I had an audition, and he you know, put a whole bunch of stuff. Of course, I didn't know how to read music or none of that, but somehow it just kind of latched on to me real quick. So I got real heavily into classical music, you know, in 12.
Wow.
So I didn't want to play. I didn't want to have anything to do with the drum set for a long time. Well, until I was 14.
Then what happened?
I opened up for you.
Actually, yeah. You were living in Seymour at the time?
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is—I can actually take over the story at this part because
you probably remember more than I do.
I remember just one or two clear things, and then the rest, of course, for the next 30 years are a little cloudy. But yeah, we there was like Joe Blanton.
Yep,
he had a band, and he's like, and I believe you called me or somebody called me. It was at your house.
Really?
Maybe Joe, because I knew him.
How? There's no way it could have been me.
No, it was probably Joe then, because I knew him from Nashville.
I was 14 and. You know,
I didn't know you were 14 before we started putting you in clubs.
Exactly. Yeah. The only thing I remember about it is they had to sneak me in the back door for sound check and ride out afterwards. And then they snuck me in the back door for the show and ride out afterwards. So, you know, highly illegal, but, you know, that was hobos, right?
But, yeah, handled professionally. But what was weird was like, I think it must have been Joe, because I knew him from Nashville. And he said, hey, come check out the band. And we want to open for the Real Hostages. And I was like, well, you got the gig because, you know, you're the only person that's asked to do it. But yeah, yeah, we'll come out and look. And we came out, and you guys were rocking. But I didn't know you were 14.
I was 14, yep. I don't remember much. I remember what it smelled like.
Hobos?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that was the first time I ever smelled a stinky, smoky punk rock dive. So it was like smelling a rose for the first time, but in the opposite direction.
Have you smelled it? Does it still? Do you, when you smell that smell now, when you walk into a place, do you go, "Oh, that."
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yep. Yeah. Okay. Yep. Yeah. This one. Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
But that band didn't last very long, right?
No, it sure didn't. But we made a demo tape, and we only played those. I think we played 3 nights with you, actually.
Yeah.
I think it was 3 nights in a row. I don't know why, but it was three. It was a 3-night run.
Yeah, it was like a weekend run.
Weird.
What was the name of the band?
Well, the band's name was good, but they were called the Omissions, which I thought was pretty cool. But anyway, yeah, it was a 3-night run, and that was the only show we ever did, or the only shows we ever did. And we made a demo tape, and that was the end of it.
And Joe Blanton blew my amp out because it had never been turned to on 10 on all levels.
Now, that's a detail that passed my way. I never heard anything about that.
Yeah, I'm about to forgive him. I've gotten to the point. I'm feeling pretty gracious. So how long after that what did you do after that next?
I guess I kind of got passed around in a few other bands. You know, I kind of got the taste of that and kind of liked it. And shortly after that, my family moved to West Knoxville. And so I switched high schools and I switched over to Farragut. And I played with some other bands over there. Graduated and ended up here in the University of Tennessee immediately afterwards, and I can't remember exactly how I got connected with Brian and Terry from Wahwa. I really don't remember. Maybe they saw one of the other groups I was playing in play at Vic and Bill's or something, but somehow I got connected to those guys and ended up, you know, shacking up with them. We moved in together and had a band for a couple of years.
How old were you when you joined Wah Wah?
I guess I would have been 17 or 18.
What was it like playing with Terry and Brian?
Well, it was pretty exciting for me, mainly because we were, you know, suddenly had that kind of band dream thing going on, because we had a band house. You know, we had a house. You were there.
Yeah, it was on Forest Avenue.
Yeah, so, you know, that's the only time I ever had that in my life, you know, where the band lives together. Everyone's got their own bedrooms. It's like the Monkees or the Beatles or something. You know, you wake up and you see the guitar player in the bathroom and stuff. You know, it's like, you know... I mean, that was pretty neat, you know. I got our own kitchen. Sort of like being on tour all the time and not going anywhere.
And then you would sit in and play with different people. And I remember you were producing like solo drum cassettes and things like that. You're pretty active from a very young age.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I don't know why I did that. I think we had the rehearsal space. We had a rehearsal space down on Gay Street, down in the basement somewhere. And I had there was nothing professional about it. I had a couple of cassette recorders or something like that. But there was something more or less, I think it was like when the band kind of fell apart, but we still had our rehearsal space. So we weren't doing anything. So I had the space to work in and time. And so I thought, well, I'll just try and do something by myself. So I just started, you know, working on things and just recording it, you know, listening back and starting to experiment with stuff like that. You know, there's some reverb units and things like that. So I just start fooling around. There's nothing else to do, you know. And you know, having the space was a real luxury, you know.
Well, yeah, I think you hit on something, too, about Knoxville at that time. I mean, in a sense, there were some things going on, but really not so much.
Not much, yeah. There wasn't, well, as I'm sure you know, but there wasn't much of any sort of an infrastructure for anything to go anywhere or anything to happen. There was no ladder to climb. You know, there was just, we were all just here, you know. I mean, more or less, you play shows and half the audience are the other bands that have nowhere else to play. And, you know, it's like it was kind of a little integrated network, but not really an infrastructure. There's nowhere really for, you know, there's nowhere to expand or do much in here. So,
is that what gave you the itch to leave?
Get out of town? Yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't say it was an itch. It was more like just getting painted into a corner, you know, and you know, so get out, you know, get out of town. I mean, if you either, you know, I just figured like, the only way I'm going to be able to do anything, or at least what I'm imagining that I could do, I just didn't see it here. I didn't see any possible. I know it's changed a lot now.
Yeah.
And people have a lot more opportunities to learn and grow and get out and play in front of people and get somewhere and do, just right here in this town. But at that time, it was kind of a dead end. I saw myself just stuck in a dead end corner, and I didn't have much of a choice. I just didn't know how to do it.
Was there was there an actual moment when you said, "I'm going"?
Yeah, there was a moment. It was a shocking moment because this is kind of a side story, but the short side of it is I got a phone call from this fella I'd written a letter to and sent some cassette tapes to. It was Greg Ginn. In Los Angeles from SST Records and Black Flag. And I had written him a letter kind of explaining my predicament, and I didn't say anything about the corner, but I did tell him that I was making plans to probably come to California that summer. I was just saving up money. And you know, maybe when I get out there, we could look each other up or something. But he, you know, I had my phone number in there, and he called my parents' house, and, you know, and they forwarded a call over to where I was working, and I just picked up the phone, and you know, someone handed me the phone, and it was Greg Ginn, and I, you know, I was like, whoa, and so he said he'd, you know, read my letter and listened to my tapes and stuff like that, and really liked what he heard, and I said, okay, cool. Well, he said, well, you say you're planning on coming on out here this summer, and I said, yeah, that's my plan. And he's like, well, what would it take for you to come out here, like, now? And I said, well, you know, I'm just saving up money for gas, and, you know, I got to make sure my car can make it and all that stuff. You know, I had my $50 Chevrolet Chevy Nova station wagon from 1963. So, he said, well, how much money do you need? And I said, oh, I don't know. I was so naive. I probably said $200 or $300 or something. And he goes, well, I'm going to wire that to you right now. And could you leave tomorrow? And, you know, I was like, yes. So I hung up the phone, and sure enough, he had wired me that money. I got it. And so I thought, oh, my God, you know, I'm leaving like tomorrow. So I called my parents and told them. Of course, they were shocked. And then after my parents, I called Bonehead, you know, next in line. I called Bonehead because he knew I was sort of planning this on the side for a while. And so he had always been, or he'd been telling me for a while, whenever you go, you got to take me with you. And I said, okay, you know. And I was thinking, well, you know, built-in bodyguard there, you know. Yeah. So I called him and I said, we're leaving tomorrow. Are you on board? And he said, yeah. That's the polite way I'll say it. he said, yes. So, you know, I packed everything I had and my drums and stuff in the station wagon and drove by the hippie house there in Fort Sanders and picked him up, and we hit the road.
At that time, did you have any inkling of, like,
not coming back?
That would be my first question.
That was my only inkling, was not coming back.
So you didn't have any fear whatsoever. I mean, you know, like most people would probably go like, yeah, this sounds real exciting, but man, it's a little, I don't know, maybe I'll screw up. Or
I already told you about the corner. I wasn't going back to the corner, so I left.
How was the actual trip out there?
It was, in retrospect now, you know, rest in peace, you know, but in retrospect, we had the craziest adventure in the world driving across the country because, well, of course, I'd never been west of the Mississippi before. And so here we go, you know, me and Bonehead drive, you know, that car was loaded to the gills and, you know, six cylinder, you know, it was doing all it could. We blew a piston about 90 miles inside of Arkansas. You know, so start thinking about that. So, yeah. You know, we broke down on the side of the highway. That was day number two, you know. So it was pretty discouraging. I had everything in the car. So I told Bonehead, I said, you stay here in the car, and I'm going to hitchhike down because, you know, it's long before cell phones and all that kind of stuff, right? So I had to hitchhike down to the next payphone and try and find that. So I was skateboarding down the highway in Arkansas, you know, and you want to hear a crazy little story?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so I'm hitchhiking. There's nobody anywhere. Finally, I see this pickup truck pulling up. It's a tow truck, and this tow truck rolls up to the side of the road, and it's an old codger there behind the wheel. The side of the passenger's door has a sign painted on it. It says Manson's Towing. And I'm like, well, so he goes, he rolls down the passenger window and he goes, is that your car I saw way back there on the side of the road? I wanted to say no, but I said, yes. He goes, you probably want me to tow you out of here, don't you? And I said, well, actually, I'm going to just go down here and make a phone call because I've got AAA. I'll throw in a little advertisement there for AAA auto towing because I had AAA Plus, yeah, which was one of the smartest things I ever had, which allowed me 100 free miles towing. Bonehead had an ex-girlfriend back in Memphis, so our plan was to get towed back to Memphis and get the car fixed back there with a family mechanic, right? So, no, sir. I just need a ride down here to the next exit. And he's like, what are you looking for? I said, a payphone. He goes, well, there's no payphones for a long way around here. And I was like, ugh. He's like, jump on in the truck and I'll drive you down to the next one. It's a ways down the road. So he pushes open the passenger door with a stick, right? I didn't realize it. Anyway, so I get up into the cab, and the first thing I notice is he doesn't have a right leg. He's only got one leg, which is on the clutch. And he's got about a 3-foot limb of a tree in his right arm that he's using for the gas pedal and the brake. I don't think this guy's going to kill me, you know. And he goes, "So where are you from?" And I said, "Well, I'm from Tennessee, you know." And actually, I said, "Well, mister, I'm from Tennessee." I said it as hillbilly as I could get it, you know, just to, you know,
make it a little smooth,
just to fit
possible.
In here. And he looked at me with one eye, you know, and sort of, you know, he said, "Well, you ain't in Tennessee no more, son." And I thought, I'm in big trouble. He goes, "Let me tell you," we're driving down the road, and he goes, "Let me tell you something. You want to get that car out of here before the sun goes down." And I thought, oh no. And I said, "Why?" And I thought he was going to say, you know, "Because we're going to come kill you and chop your head off or something." But he was like, he's like, "Mosquitoes." I thought, I've never been so scared. He said, "Mosquitoes." I said, "Mosquitoes?" He goes, "Yeah, big as helicopters." And I thought, oh man, we are going to die out here. And he goes,
"Did they eat your leg?"
He said, "Yeah, I did. I didn't bring up the leg."
Yeah, that's a good idea.
But anyway, you know, don't mention the war. So anyway, he did. He drove me down. You know, I called and made a request for a tow truck to come get us. And I got a ride with somebody there at that gas station back the other way. And I got back to Bonehead, you know, and he was waiting for me. I said, "Tow truck's on the way. We got to get out of here." And he's like, "What's going on?" And I said, "Mosquitoes." I said, "Big as helicopters, man. We're in big trouble. We better hope that truck is here before. If the mosquitoes don't get us, I know who is." You know, so
the mosquitoes are soften you up for the next predators.
Yeah, Mr. Manson and his buddies. So anyway, the tow truck driver showed up, and he was as nice as could be. Really, really cool man, African-American man who actually lived not too far, about halfway between there and Memphis. And he goes, "So you boys want to get towed back to Memphis, I understand." And we said, "Yes, sir, we certainly do." He's like, "Well, you know, I could probably fix your car for you." And we're like, "Well, yeah, we know, but, you know, we've got family back in Memphis and, you know, a family mechanic." And he's like, "Well, it doesn't matter because I can't tow you there till tomorrow anyway." We thought, oh no. He's like, "But this is what we're going to do. I'm going to tow you back to my house, and you boys can spend the night there, and I'll drive you back first thing in the morning." And I'm thinking, oh man, wow, okay. So we don't really have much of a choice. So we say, okay. So he hooks up my car, and we get in the cab, and we're driving back about halfway, about 45 miles or something. And we just pull off and we go out into the swamp, out in the woods, and we come up to his house. And Bonehead and I are looking at each other like, you know, we're going to have to talk, you know. So he pulls up, you know, he's been talking to us along the way. He's like, "I'm sure I can fix that car." We were talking about it. And he said, "Oh, you had white smoke coming out of the tailpipe. Well, you've blown a piston, I'll tell you that right now." And I'm thinking, oh, man, you know, how much money have I got in my pocket here? I mean, you know, all the money I had was in my pocket.
Was it cash?
Yeah. So anyway, he said, "Well, I tell you what, let's get you set up. You spend the night at my house. We're going to, I could take a quick little look at the engine and just sort of give you an idea if I could, you know, how much trouble it would be." He looked at it a bit and he's like, "Well, you know, you probably want to go ahead and go back to Memphis, you know." So we said, okay, so we're going to spend the night. It's dark. And he's got a pickup truck on stilts in the backyard with a camper on the back, one of those things. And that's where we're going to sleep. So I get in there, and Bonehead and I immediately start making plans for what we're going to do when we get jumped and how we're going to rendezvous and how long, and you run that way and I'll run that way. We're going to split up. We're coming up with a whole midnight evacuation plan and how we're going to get back together and all this stuff. Well, that never happened.
Yeah, and I can imagine the tow truck driver in his house with his wife going, all right, here's the plan if these two weird Tennessee guys jump us.
We were sitting there talking to each other, making these plans, and somehow through the screen window, this insect got through, and it was a mosquito, and it fell down on the picnic table, you know, the camper kitchen table that we were sitting at. It fell down right between us on the table. It was so, well, this might be kind of gross for the air. It was so full of blood that it couldn't fly off the table. And we were looking at that thinking, we're going to die. Look at that thing. And so we were like, suddenly we started examining every window and cracking the screens. And we were just, it was an emergency situation. That was a big thing. And anyway, we didn't get eaten alive. We didn't get robbed. We got up the next morning, and that fella drove us back to Memphis. And we got the car in the garage, and it was going to take nearly all of my money to fix it, you know, and I had to call my dad back here and tell him. And he was just telling me, well, you know, more or less, well, you know, you tried, you know, nice try, you know, maybe, you know, I guess you better turn around and come on back. And I was like, no way. This thing is going to make it. And that car got us out to Los Angeles. It made it all the way. And I drove it for about two more weeks before the engine cracked, you know. It got us out there, though. But, you know, we had wild adventures every day. You know, we didn't have hotels or anything like that. We just sleep every night we try and find some weird place to pull off and sleep where we wouldn't get robbed or arrested. And, there was only enough room in the car for me to sleep in the front seat. And of course you recall Bonehead was a pretty big fella.
Yeah.
So where do you think he had to sleep?
On top.
Fortunately, I had a station wagon and it was just long enough for his big carcass to sleep on the top of the car. So he'd sleep on top of the car and I'd sleep in the front seat. And I wish I had had a camera or something then, because I didn't, but I had some great mornings waking up out in the middle of nowhere in the desert, and you know, he'd still be up on top of the car snoring like a beached whale up there. I probably could have started driving a few hours and he wouldn't have even woken him up. I could have just strapped him on up there. It would have been quite a vision.
It seems like your experience in Arkansas almost was like a great primer for the music business.
Well, it did teach me one thing. If I ever have to drive through Arkansas again, I'm going to go around.
You have been listening to part one of our interview on Flipside with Larry Mullins. It gets even crazier from here, so you definitely want to listen to part two. Larry is in town this weekend with the Big Ears Festival. Part two will be on the website here shortly. I'm Todd Steed. Have a great weekend.